You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. Guys, it's our 100th episode. We made it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting us. We love doing this, and we love your feedback. So hit us with your thoughts and suggestions and maybe perhaps even criticism or two at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. All right, today's episode, Associate Editor Emil Stonick and Test Kitchen Manager Brad Leone sit down with fermentation expert, or as he calls himself, fermentation revivalist, Sandor Katz. Katz has two cookbooks, Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, the latter of which won a James Beard Foundation Award in 2012. Both of those books go in deep on the history and benefits of fermenting, as well as how to do it yourself. Vegetables into sauerkraut and kimchi, sugar into alcohol, milk into yogurt, and so much more. All right, you guys ready to nerd out? Let's do this thing. Emil, Brad, and Sandor.
I'm here with Brad Leone, our test kitchen manager, and Sandor Katz, storied cookbook author? I don't know. Would you call your books cookbooks?
Sure. I mean, they're guiding people, in techniques for working with food, and some of them involve cooking and some of them don't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sandor Katz, fermentation guru, fetishist, as you self-identify as a fermentation fetishist.
Well, when I wrote Wild Fermentation in 2003, that was how I described myself, and it certainly got me plenty of attention. These days I mostly describe myself as a fermentation revivalist. I'll still accept the other title.
Uh-huh. All right. So, and you're the author of Wild Fermentation, which came out 2003 and is being reissued in its second edition?
Yeah, yeah. The revised edition just came out maybe 2 months ago. So it's updated, mostly based on the additional knowledge and experience that I have as a fermentation educator. Mm-hmm. Try to explain things more clearly, more focus on building concepts, some new recipes, took some of the old ones out, improved some of the other old ones, and we added lots of beautiful color photos.
Cool. And in between the first edition of Wild Fermentation and the second, you wrote a little book called The Art of Fermentation, which won a James Beard Award and a lot of stuff like that. So, it's not like you were sitting on your hands in the meantime.
No, and I've also, I've also been traveling quite extensively teaching fermentation workshops all over the place. And that's where I first met you, was in one such workshop.
Yeah, that's true, at Roe Camp and Conference Center up in the Berkshires. The first thing I wanted to talk a little bit about fermentation culture, no pun intended, kind of more globally. And then I'm sure Brad's excited to talk about some of the more technical, nerdy stuff.
Not too technical.
No, we're not going to bore anybody here. When Wild Fermentation first came out in 2003, it did very much feel like not niche-y, but it was very much like this kind of DIY, like anarcho-revivalist, like homesteadery sort of book, and it felt very much like a zine. It was all illustrated. There were no photos. It was like a secret handshake a little bit. Like you would go into people's kitchens and you would see Wild Fermentation and you knew that they were kind of up to something. Fermentation really has changed in the way that it exists in our food culture, both in restaurants and home kitchens. And I'm just curious to know how it feels to kind of be a part of that and where you see yourself in that kind of transition from the super niche to the almost at this point mainstream.
Well, I mean, it's certainly gratifying that, so many people are interested in the things that I've been writing about and talking about. But I mean, I think you're right. I mean, Wild Fermentation, the book, grew out of a zine that I wrote and self-published in 2001. And, doing your own fermentation, in your home kitchen is something that is of interest to a relatively, sort of small subset of the population. I think we have to separate the products of fermentation from the process of fermentation. Mm-hmm. And the products of fermentation have never, ever, ever waned in their popularity. You know, beer and wine have not suddenly become of interest to people. Bread and cheese and cured meats have not suddenly become of interest to people. You know, kombucha, I will grant you, is an example of something that has come into prominence in the last 15 years. But I would say in general, you know, most of the products of fermentation have always been popular, are popular today, and in all likelihood will be popular for hundreds or thousands of years to come. And fermentation is so integral to all of our culinary traditions. But, you know, over the course of the 20th century, as people got, you know, less and less intimately involved in food production and, you know, kind of agriculture and all of the basic transformational processes that turn the products of agriculture into the things we like to eat, just largely disappeared from our day-to-day lives. So, you know, fermentation became something mysterious, you know, because all aspects of food production were disappearing from our daily lives. And, you know, I would say in the last 15 or 20 years, we're seeing just a broader renewed interest in food, how it's produced, where it comes from, by what methods it's transformed. And once you start interrogating your food and asking questions like that, fermentation just is, you know, among the answers.
I think you're really right. You know, like, as fermentation is becoming a less weird word for people to hear, I still feel like there's such a disconnect, though, because, like, when I tell somebody and they're like, oh, like, what do you, like, how do you ferment that kombucha? And you're like, oh, well, you actually have this, you know, this symbiotic colony of yeast and bacteria that's eating the sugars. And, like, they're like, oh, colony of yeast and bacteria?
People have become so separated from their food. You know, you go to the supermarket or, you know, and you just buy something in a little package and you cook it or whatever. But, you know, a lot of people with fermentation are afraid of getting sick. You know, it's this big, you know, demystifying it, I think, is one of the biggest challenges. And just, you know, having recipes and certain things where people could start, I think, is super important.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know, Brad, for you, for those of you who don't know, Brad, who's our test kitchen manager, has an alcove in the test kitchen that's basically fully devoted to all of his fermentation experiments. He's got kombuchas, he's got fermenting honey, he's got misos. And I feel like over the past few years, you have had to kind of convince some of our coworkers that what you're doing is safe and desirable and delicious. I mean, what has that process been like for you? Like, I know there have been some naysayers who you've managed to convert.
Well, I started, you know, just read a couple things and just started, you know, like, I'm by no means a master, or, you know, every time I do it, I'm learning a little bit.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's great. You know? So, like, as I've evolved, you know, people have, and I've been eating it and coming to work the next day, people have kind of, you know, been like, all right, well, he's not getting sick. He's not invincible. In fact, he's full of energy and bouncing off the walls. So, I don't know, maybe that's it. People just start, you know, coworkers eventually, you know, some more than others, have come along to fermenting foods. But it's just like, you know, and I've learned a few things, like, you know, certain aspects of fermenting, you know, where it can harbor bad bacteria, you know, certain things can't live in a certain pH or a certain, you know, so once you kind of get those basic guidelines down, it so far seems pretty safe.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that there's an interesting, the question of safety is an interesting one, because it's also like, you know, you think about, like, in a lot of ways, our cleanliness has made, you know, as a culture has almost made our food less safe in a certain way, that, you know, a lot of the naturally occurring yeast and bacteria that are used to preserve different foods actually will protect those foods from the same things that we're terrified of, the E. coli and the salmonellas and the listeria.
Safety. And I mean, I get it all the time. I mean, you know, people who project their anxiety about bacteria onto fermented foods. So, you know, they're following a recipe to make sauerkraut. Could be from my book. It could be from The Joy of Cooking. It's not like I made this stuff up. It's everywhere. So, like, you know, you chop up your cabbage, you salt it, you pound it or squeeze it a little bit, get it juicy, stuff it into a jar, get it submerged under its own juices. And then people start to worry. And so I get this email, you know, once a month, you know, how can I be sure that I have good bacteria growing on my fermenting cabbage and not dangerous bacteria that is going to make somebody sick or even kill somebody? And you know, the reason you know this is that there has never been any documented cases of food poisoning or illness from this food. Like, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, this is among the safest foods that we know.
Wow.
And, you know, every year we hear about, you know, people getting sick from raw vegetables. So, you know, clearly there's the potential for, you know, vegetables growing in a field to be contaminated. Usually the story is manure from a factory farm uphill washes over the field of vegetables. It could just as well happen as a result of sloppy handling, somebody failing to wash their hands at, you know, critical hygienic moments. But, you know, even if you took vegetables that had been subjected to some sort of incidental contamination and you chopped them up, salted them, get them juicy, stuff them in a jar to ferment them, what's going to happen is the indigenous population of lactic acid bacteria are going to dominate. And as they acidify the environment, it kills off the pathogenic bacteria. Sauerkraut is so safe that no one ever has to do this, but sometimes in salami making or in certain kinds of cheese making, the producers are actually required to intentionally introduce known pathogenic bacteria that people worry about into the raw products so that they can prove that their process would kill them.
Wow.
So, I mean, fermentation really is, you know, like a strategy for safety. And, you know, I think, you know, what Brad was saying, I mean, it's important to understand like the selective environment you were trying to create, you know, because that's what's going to determine which organisms are going to grow. On any raw food, there's an elaborate community of different kinds of organisms, and which of them will grow, which of them will dominate, depends entirely on environmental considerations. And so, you know, you could even go so far as to say that the practice of fermentation is a matter of manipulating environmental conditions so as to encourage the growth of certain kinds of organisms and simultaneously discourage the growth of other kinds of organisms. So, I mean, it really is a safe a process. There's an incredible like track record of safety. I don't mean to suggest that there's zero possibility that anything could ever go wrong, but at least in the realm of fermenting vegetables, all the things that can go wrong are things that are visible and will be abundantly clear to you.
You usually know when something goes south, you know?
Well, I think a thing that's interesting, you know, hearing you say that is, you know, there is this kind of Venn diagram and there's a significant overlap between people who are really interested in this stuff for whether it's for health or for flavor, but are also still terrified of the idea that they're going to get sick and have this intense anxiety around bacteria. I remember when I was at the workshop that you did in Massachusetts, there was somebody, a woman who had been doing some of her own sauerkraut and playing around with some of her own fermentation. And she knew it was really good for her, but she was really nervous about it. And she was like, so when I am making sauerkraut, I make sure to sterilize the jars. I normally put them in the dishwasher on the heavy cycle to make sure that they're come up to a certain temperature. And then, you know, I use a certain kind of soap and I'm wondering what your techniques are and the things that you worry about. And you said, you paused and you were like, you know, I try to make sure that there's no soap left over in it after I wash it, but that's pretty much it.
Right. I mean, why do you need the jar to be sterile if, like, the hands you're working with aren't right. sterile and, you know, the air around you isn't sterile and whatever kind of, you know, utensil you might use to, you know, press the vegetables down in the jar isn't going to be sterile. So, I mean, sterility really is a fantasy. So, sterileness is just beside the point and not necessary. I mean, you want everything to be clean. You want your hands right. to be clean, the utensils, the vessels to be clean, but you don't have to go to any extraordinary lengths, and whatever kind of, you know, incidental environmental bacteria are present are not going to be significant in the process.
Right. At the end of the day, you know, we're not making microchips, we're making food.
Right. Well, I mean, and I think that's kind of, I feel like you could sum it up in like, you know, look, you want to be, you could make bacteria the enemy or you could make friends. And it kind of seems like making friends is actually easier than trying to fight all of the bacteria that's anywhere and kind of
you're outnumbered.
Yeah, we really are outnumbered.
Well, and I mean, I would say, you know, the war on bacteria is a historical period that we are passing out of.
Right.
I mean, nobody well-versed in biology thinks of bacteria as the enemy anymore. We could never survive without bacteria. Bacteria provide all kinds of essential services for us within our bodies and in the environment around us. And, they're just, you know, really the fabric of life. You know, evolutionary biologists, you know, are rapidly approaching a consensus that all life has evolved from bacteria. No form of life has ever lived without bacteria. And, I think we kind of have to approach the problem differently and recognize that bacteria, I mean, you know, friends or enemies, like they're just a reality. They're right. The matrix of life, and they're part of us. And, we need healthy bacterial populations in our bodies in order to remain healthy. And so we just have to shift strategies. And rather than, kind of indiscriminate warfare of trying to kill all of them, you know, we have to work on, ways to, cultivate the bacteria that make us healthier. And, for the time being, I would say that, the most effective means we have are the traditional methods of fermenting food. And if you're going to get involved in fermenting food, you're going to have to make some kind of a peace with bacteria in your kitchen.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask one more question kind of before we move into the kitchen and kind of some of the nerdier aspects of this. But often you are described as and self-identify as an activist. When I read that, it makes me feel like fermentation is a part of something kind of larger and cultural, both in the, microbiological sense, but in the kind of larger socio-cultural sense. And I'm just wondering, how do you see your work with fermentation as activism? How does that kind of play in?
Well, I would say in all kinds of different levels. So, I mean, on the one hand, I think that, empowering people with, techniques for working with food that can enable them to, eat healthier food and share healthier food with people around them, is in and of itself, a valuable form of social activism, simply in, making the possibility of better and more nourishing food available to more people. And I certainly, in the teaching that I do, I'm always seeking out, venues that, will be as accessible as possible to, the broadest cross section of people. I'm interested in, the empowerment of sharing skills, in a largely de-skilled society. But beyond that, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that, fermentation is full of powerful metaphors, and fermentation is much more than, a transformative, sort of process that, turns raw products of agriculture into all these delicious foods and beverages. If you search any kind of media database, you'll find, references to a period of great cultural ferment, political ferment, intellectual ferment, social ferment, spiritual ferment, religious ferment, whatever it is. It has to do with excitement. The word fermentation comes from Latin fervere, which means to boil. And it's because the visible action of fermentation is bubbles of carbon dioxide rising in liquids, just as the visible action of boiling in water would be the bubbles rising. But when we use it in a metaphorical sense, it means the bubbles of people who are excited, people who are, talking about ideas that are exciting to them, whether those are political ideas or spiritual ideas or intellectual ideas. When people are excited about ideas, when ideas are taking hold because so many people are excited about them and talking about them, it's the talking about them that is the bubble. So I think that, fermentation just also is a powerful metaphor. And, for people who are activists and who, sort of conceptualize of their role in the world, changing the world and making it a better place, well, we are the seed cultures. So I just think, you know, fermentation is full of, you know, amazing, you know, metaphors that are useful for thinking about social change and social change movements.
Totally.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, so I guess we, you know, want to kind of transition into us talking about, you know, Brad, some of the things that you're working on in the test kitchen, and for you guys to get to talk a little bit. I know, Brad, you brought some kombucha for us to try.
Yeah, let's open a bottle real quick, right? Shall we?
What are we looking at?
It's just purple. Concord flavor, Concord grape.
And so how did you do that? Did you put the mature kombucha over some grapes or mix it with some grape juice?
Yeah. So what I have done both. So what I do is I just start with like the basic tea.
You want to walk us through what kombucha is for those in the audience?
To the best of my knowledge, yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know, like you said before, people start with a SCOBY. What a SCOBY is, a symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast, and that's all in the liquid. That's like the beneficial part of kombucha, if I'm not mistaken. And so it's already in the liquid. So when you put it...
But when people talk about the SCOBY, they're not talking about the liquid. It's this little like rubbery pancake-looking thing that
like
rests on top.
It looks like a laminated biscuit made of wax.
But if you get like a thing of kombucha at the store, it might be the thing that's kind of like
little
at the
floater.
End. It's like a little loogie in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And really so, selling people on
so you
beverages.
Could, When you put it in the jar and you feed it with a tea and sugar, it's like a sweet tea combination. The SCOBY is, every time it forms a new layer. And what it is the bacteria, to the best of my understanding, the bacteria and yeast are really happy. So they make this protective wall on the top of the surface, because the liquid is just, everything's really good for them right now. They don't want any foreign intruders coming in. So they build this big protective, what we call the mother, the SCOBY. And so there are all the actions going on in the liquid.
Okay. And so there, and this SCOBY is, what's it eating? Is it eating the sugar?
The sugar and parts from the tea. I believe some of the tannins from the tea. And then once it gets to a nice, like kind of sweet, kind of tart spot, still has a little hint of tea flavor. Then I put it into another vessel and I put it into like fermentation beer making bottles with the little pop tops.
So these are like the flip top kind of things that you might see like French lemonade in sometimes. It's got like a little grommet.
Sure, but you want to make, a lot of them are just made like that when you go out to dinner and they have these little bottles of water everywhere. A lot of them aren't, the glass isn't rated for pressure, for fermentation. So you want to get ones that are made for a fermentation food grade, like a beer making bottle. They sell them online because a lot of the other ones are just decorative. And under the pressure, I've had some blow up.
And I think it's really good to emphasize this point for people who want to experiment with carbonating sweet, lightly fermented beverages like kombucha, is that, you know, there's still sugar in there. It's actively fermenting and it can build up a lot of pressure, and it is not uncommon to hear stories of bottles exploding. So, you know, if you do this, you want to really do it with caution and keep a close eye on them. What I like to do just as a safety practice is with each batch, bottle at least one bottle in a recycled plastic soda bottle, so I can feel when you first fill it up, you can squeeze it and it doesn't resist at all. But as the pressure builds, it resists your squeezing more and more. So that's a really easy way to monitor the pressure. But bottles do explode, so you have to really approach this with caution.
Yeah, and I've found, like you said, like sometimes I'll use just store-bought juices as the secondary. So after the first fermentation, in with the SCOBY, I put it in a bottle with a little bit of fruit juice. And then you cap it and let it stay at room temperature for, depending on how warm your room is. And that's where the carbonation will happen.
So that's like, so the, all the bacteria that are in the mature kombucha are now eating the new sugars and producing
right, it's
CO2.
Like a little primer, a little last meal kind of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that gives them, so when they eat the sugar, that's where the carbon, you know, carbon dioxide happens. And then with being capped, it just gets reconstituted into the liquid. I believe that's how it works. And yeah. And then, like you said before, and I've used fresh, where I go to like the farmer's market and I'll get like fresh grapes or whatever kind of juice, fruit, and I'll juice it and I'll use that in there. And I get, because it's not, most juices are pasteurized that you go and buy in the store, so they're dead. But when you make your own juice, it's got its own little life, its own little funkwa to it. And I've had much more success with, it's much more active, I found, when you use. I mean, it makes sense to have, when it has its own life force in it already. It's just adding to the party.
Well, and these secondary fermentations for kombucha are really the source of all these amazing flavors that we're seeing. And for people doing home fermentation of kombucha, I mean, really the experimentation could be endless. I mean, there's nothing that you could not,
and that's part,
you
know, of the
incorporate
fun.
Into it. Yeah.
And so, I've tried another thing since we're talking about carbonated liquids, where I took some fresh Concord grapes that from the farmer's market and just some white grapes that they had, and I mashed them, in a big jar, and then I let it ferment, just on a table for a few days. It gets very bubbly. Things start happening. I stir it every day. It starts smell. I keep it closed. I was reading somewhere that if you leave it open, sometimes it can start getting a little vinegary. Dude, from the oxygen, I'd imagine. So I keep it closed. It gets a little bubbly. It gets a pretty dry. Starts getting tasting like bad wine. And then I'm straining it and bottling it the same way I was doing the kombucha. And I try to get it carbonated. And it seems to be pretty active. I recently had an accident where one of them, I was bottling them, and I didn't have a smaller bottle, so I didn't leave the proper headspace, which we didn't mention before, but when you do bottle in the glass, you have to leave, you know, a good, you know, inch or two of headspace on from the liquid to the top. And that's very important for the carbonation process.
And especially for bottles not exploding quickly.
The pressure. Yeah, sure. And so I left too much, and I believe it was still a little too sweet. Maybe I could have let it go a little further. But I let it go for like 3 days at room temp, and I was looking at it, and it didn't, sometimes I just give it a little shake and you can see the bubbles coming up, and it didn't seem carbonated at all. And before you open one that you let go in the carbonation, you should really chill it first.
Absolutely. What the story you're telling just makes me think of a larger point that I'd love to make, which is that, I mean, kombucha is really just the tip of the iceberg in the realm of lightly fermented beverages. And, you know, there's lots of different ways you can make lightly fermented beverages. You can use ginger as a starter and do, you know, ginger beer or root beers or things with just grating ginger into a little sugar water. Use organic ginger because a lot of non-organic ginger also has been subjected to irradiation, so it won't really have the bacteria and yeast in it that organic ginger will. You can just use fruit as a starter. I like to make what I call fruit kvass. Being a Russian word for lightly fermented beverages. And, just fruit in sugar water for a few days yields such a beautiful, fresh kind of a flavor that's vigorously bubbly and satisfying.
Do you do a secondary on that, or you just drink it right from the air?
Yeah, usually I just do. Well, I mean,
its own little tang.
What I'll do is leave it in an open leave it with on the fruit, and then I'll strain the fruit out and then seal it into a bottle and let it carbonate for another day.
Nice. Yeah, so I had one and I left too much headspace on it. And I don't know if that's why it happened, but I opened it up and, I mean, as soon as I broke the seal, the glass turned into sand. Like, it sounded like a gun went off. I had little cuts all over my hands from the, I mean, luckily nothing got in anyone's eyes or anything. But I wanted to ask you, do you think that's just because, did that have anything to do with the headspace being too great? Like, it built up this crazy little pocket of pressure bomb, or maybe it just had too much sugar.
I would say probably the latter. Too much sugar. I mean, any of these lightly fermented beverages, you know, there's a lot of sugar in them. You probably want to drink them while they still have some of the sugar in them. So yeah, I mean, too much sugar, but really it's too long in the bottle without being off-gassed.
Okay.
Because sometimes people use bottles like that and like, you know, every 12 hours they'll just sort of loosen the top to burp it, release the pressure, get a sense of how fast the pressure is building in there. You know, Russian cuisine has a great little trick of putting a single raisin in the bottle. And when the raisin rises to the top, that's your indication that the bottle has carbonated.
Oh, I like that.
Because it's little bubbles of carbon dioxide that are making the raisin rise to the top.
Interesting.
You know, one of the things that I really love about all of these different processes and kind of having fermentation as a part of your kitchen life is that you are, you know, you were just talking about people kind of checking on their ferments and burping them and releasing gas and things like that. It's like, it really does feel like you have a pet.
Miss it over the weekend.
It's like you miss it. You like go my home projects. To your actual child.
I think about it. I get a little excited on Monday morning. I get to go in and check on my babies.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's fun because it feels like it's, you know, while, you know, other cooking processes, you cook, you know, you braise something for a couple of hours or, you know, you're chopping something, you're tossing it, you eat it. And then it's kind of, and then you say goodbye. And then, you know, the ferments, I feel like you have this, there's this anticipation, this waiting. I feel like for me, fermenting foods in my own kitchen really made the kitchen feel, you know, for lack of a better word, alive and lively when I wasn't there, that there was kind of this life, you know, outside of my manipulation going on.
And it's exciting. And there is a lot of anticipation. Actually, you know, I'm staying with my brother and sister-in-law and nephew. And my 14-year-old nephew has gotten into making yogurt. And last night he made some yogurt. But there was a lot of excitement this morning. Yeah. Like, oh my God, let's check the yogurt. Did it work? It worked. It's beautiful. It's thick.
It's great for relationships. I mean, it really does just like bring people together in a way, like, you know, like, they say, you know, like having a meal with friends or, you know, is a great thing. But like same with like fermentation, you know, and you meet people that are doing it as well. And you know, you share tips and you talk about it and you meet somebody else. And it's just, it's a neat little culture.
So yeah, what we're looking at is Brad's Concord Grape Kombucha. It's like fizzy. It's kind of like a, ruddy, purpley.
It's a nice
red color.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Mine has a little kind of loogy, scoby.
That's a mother.
Hanging out in this there.
If you were to put that in a new vessel and feed it, it would.
It's got
a really nice level of carbonation. It's got a beautiful balance of, you know, the acidity and the sweetness. I mean, there's a lot of subjectivity to this. I mean, people always want to know when is it done, and it's done when it tastes good to you,
right?
And that's just different for everyone. So some people, you know, some people make it and to me it's sickeningly sweet, or sometimes people will make it and it tastes like vinegar, but it could be anywhere, you know, sort of on that spectrum. And it's highly subjective. I mean, really almost all fermentation, you know, people want to know with sauerkraut, like, when is it ready? How long does it take? But there's no objective date when it's ready. It's you know, it's ready when the acids like have accumulated to your liking.
Sure. I mean, they can be similar, but I find like with all fermentation, every project, it's, you know, even if you do the same thing, tends to be a little different each time. And that's kind of a good thing too.
Yeah. I remember you telling a story at the conference that I went to about going on going on a tour to promote wild fermentation and going to different places and don't, you know, you were trucking around some buckets of sauerkraut that had gone for many weeks and was really potent and, you know, giving some to people and then finding it a little freaky and then giving it to these two older, I think, German or Eastern European women who are like, well, it's good coleslaw. And then having to make a new fresh batch that wasn't very fermented and it was only a couple days old and handing that out. And some people just loving that kind of fresh, very lightly fermented, you know. I feel like people have a lot of different, you know, it's to your taste. And that is kind of, there is no right or wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the historical context for that is, you know, people, it was survival food through a winter. So people would ferment it for a long time over a whole winter. But that doesn't mean you have to wait 6 months before or 6 weeks before you eat it. You know, it's really very good younger. And as you described, I mean, many people will eat a three-day-old kraut and say like, wow, that's delicious. I thought I didn't even like sauerkraut, but that's great.
One more question before we lose Mr. Katz. So with fermenting garlic, I'm doing a little honey and garlic fermentation thing, and it's like a little medicine that I believe in, and I think it's wonderful. A lot of people are scared of botulism being tied to garlic and fermenting, and I like to put it in a lot of stuff, and I haven't had any problems.
Yeah. Well, so, okay. There have been a couple of cases of botulism related to garlic under olive oil.
Right.
So if you want to preserve garlic under olive oil, I would say what would make that absolutely safe would be to marinate the garlic in vinegar before you put it in the olive oil, because the acidity of the vinegar would kill off the botulism organisms. In honey, I don't think that would be a problem at all. And I mean, the problem isn't garlic per se. The problem is under olive oil, something that's really juicy like garlic under olive oil. But I mean, garlic and honey, I don't think that would be a concern at all, really.
Right.
And, I mean, there's nothing intrinsic to garlic that makes it, botulism is something that comes up a lot.
Right.
It's a big... it's the most notorious food poisoning toxin. It's produced by this bacteria, Clostridium botulinum, which is such a common soil organism that probably, 95% of the, plant material most of us eat has been exposed to cells of Clostridium botulinum, but it can only develop under such a specific, environmental condition. You know, in the realm of fermented vegetables, there's just no concern of it because you're in a watery environment where there's dissolved oxygen. Clostridium botulinum can only function, it's called an obligate anaerobe. It can only function in a totally anaerobic environment, which is what we create when we're doing canning. Mm-hmm. And that's, why we know the name botulism. Historically, botulism was associated with botulus, which is the Latin word for sausages, fermented sausages, salamis. But just mostly we just don't have to think about it or worry about it because, the environments we're working with all have dissolved oxygen in them. So there's just no possibility for
and
that
usually
bacteria
acidic.
To develop. And certainly acidic also, yeah.
Right. Well, thank you.
Cool. Well, Sander Katz, thank you so much for joining us. Brad Leone, thanks for
always a pleasure.
Being here also.
Thanks so much. Cool. Thanks so much for inviting me here.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.